Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin, just ahead of President Obama's last State of the Union address, with an update on whether Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps have managed to upstage Obama by seizing two American patrol boats and 10 U.S. sailors who apparently drifted into Iranian territorial waters, as well as look into the terrorist bombing at a popular tourist site in Istanbul that Turkish authorities are attributing to Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State. A former foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the State Department during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, David Phillips, joins us to discuss this latest example of the U.S. getting blindsided by events in the Middle East and the irony that Turkey's president, who started a war against the Kurds to win an election, is now suffering blowback from Daesh, the terrorist group he previously secretly armed and offered safe haven to. Then, with the president expected to deliver an unconventional State of the Union address that is both optimistic and reassuring, we will assess why a handful of terrorists have the most powerful nation on earth living in fear when data shows that the annual risk of dying in a terrorist attack in the U.S. between 1970 and 2007 was 1 in 3.5 million. John Mueller, the author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks and Costs of Homeland Security and Chasing Ghosts, the Policing of Terrorism, joins us to discuss Obama's conundrum of how to speak truth to a fearful nation. Then finally, we'll hear from two presidential speechwriters, David Halperin, a former Special Assistant for National Security Affairs to President Clinton, and Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, who was a senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. We'll discuss how much President Obama's planned speech will be impacted by the possibility that Iran's Death to America shouting Revolutionary Guards Corps are holding American sailors hostage while the president speaks of progress in fighting terrorism. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a former foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And I guess what's just happened in the Persian Gulf is an example of how often American presidents get blindsided. This could not be happening at a worse time for President Obama. And even though there are reassurances that the sailors will be returned, it's not the best optics, is it, for the president going into the State of the Union?
It's not good optically, but it also raises some very serious policy questions. We're just about to enter a new phase in Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. If they do certain things, we're going to liberate $100 billion of money that's been frozen over many years. How are they going to use that money? Are they going to use it to support terrorist groups? Are they going to continue with their warmongering in the Straits of Hormuz? And now we have a major row between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with broader sectarian implications in Iraq and other countries. This is an example of being blindsided. It's also an example of how foreign affairs, particularly in the Middle East, is so unpredictable.
Well, the other side of the coin might well be that this is an example of military incompetence. I mean, the boats, apparently, one of them broke down and ran aground near Farsi Island, which is an IRGC stronghold, and it's Iranian territory. And they've always been incredibly aggressive, the IRGC. They seized a bunch of British sailors during the Iraq War under similar circumstances. And, you know, it sort of reminds me of the possibility, for example, a Hellfire missile was shipped to Cuba, for God's sake. I mean, obviously the president is calling the chief of naval operations and saying, what the hell happened here?
And we should have known better. Just a few days ago, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were firing at U.S. warships in the Persian Gulf. So how is it possible that a patrol boat went off course or broke down, and we now have 10 U.S. troops that are held hostage by the IRGC? Just an example of how far the U.S. military has fallen with all the budget cuts and the continual wars over the past dozen years. You know, we live in a bad world, and we need to be equipped to deal not only with terrorist threats, but conventional threats. Iran has not shown itself to be friendly to U.S. interests, so we should know better than to be putting our patrol boats into harm's way.
Well, I'm not sure about how much our military is being cut. We're spending over 60% more on defense than we did during any year during the Cold War, when we had a real enemy that could wipe us off the map. I mean, it just seems to me there should have been some political caution here, because we know that Iran is essentially two countries, run by the IRGC and the hardliners, and the other by the president, who Obama's made a deal with. And as you pointed out on Friday, he gets $100 billion plus money into his coffers. So they're reassuring, apparently, the United States that the sales will be returned. It's not dawn yet in the Persian Gulf. So it does look like there'll be some uncertainty as the president stands before the Congress. And already I was watching CNN before I went on the air, and Senator Tom Cotton was just almost gleeful that Obama was embarrassed by the Iranians.
The IRGC opposes the nuclear deal with Iran. They can use the taking of 10 U.S. sailors as leverage, not so much with the United States, but within the Iranian political field, to try to get the hardliners in a position where they can slow down or even take steps to disassociate from the Iranian nuclear accord. This is it's not an auspicious moment for U.S. sailors to be held by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and our experience with U.S. hostages in Iran hasn't been good over decades now.
Let's now turn to Turkey, which was, of course, the original reason why I called you to have a conversation about this latest terrorist attack in a very popular tourist area of Istanbul. It appears that the Daesh, the Islamic State, are aiming at hurting Turkey's tourist business, which I believe is a huge and important part of their economy. But it also feels like this is blowback that Erdogan is getting from the very people that he harbored, gave safe haven to, gave safe passage to, secretly armed. I'm talking about Daesh, the Islamic State. And more recently, of course, he literally reignited a war with the Kurds in order to win an election and grab more power for himself. And just, about a week ago, he praised Adolf Hitler, an extraordinary turn of events.
It really raises some questions about Turkey's suitability as an ally. And we also have to look at sort of Turkey's neighborhood. It finds itself now in conflict with almost every single neighbor. And Erdogan is pursuing a policy of regional conflict, relaunching a war against the PKK. The Kurdistan Workers' Party was a cynical effort to gain votes from nationalists in Turkey, and it worked. For years, Turkey provided logistical support, money, weapons, and health care to wounded warriors in Syria. They thought they could control these jihadi groups. Now they're discovering that they've created a monster, and that monster is now targeting Turkey. So Turkey finds itself deeply destabilized, real questions within NATO about its suitability. And the U.S., which always treasured Turkey as the eastern flank of NATO, is having serious second thoughts about its alliance with Turkey and whether or not Turkey is a reliable partner.
But are the Turkish people having second thoughts? I mean, Erdogan has polarized the people between the secular and modern looking towards Europe, people who want to be part of the European Union, for example, and the more rural conservative Islamists. But you would think with these terrorist attacks, and this is not the first, and this one striking at the heart of the tourist center of Istanbul, this is going to have a terrible impact on Turkey's $30 billion tourist sector.
Well, the tourism business is already affected by the fact that Russians are now not coming. And they're not coming because Turkey shot down a Russian warplane that entered Turkish airspace for 13 seconds. Now, Erdogan is following a page from Slobodan Milosevic's playbook. He's creating problems that only he can solve. And the Turkish electorate want stability. They want to regain the good fortunes of the early years of Erdogan's reign. And they're supporting Erdogan. They need to look much more critically at the government, this move towards an executive presidency, constitutional reform that would create a president with paramount powers, is extremely dangerous in any setting. And you mentioned earlier Erdogan's praise for Hitler's Germany. It was in this context, because he was talking about Hitler's Germany as a country with a presidential system that wasn't federal. You know, when a ruler starts praising Adolf Hitler, and he's a NATO ally, that's serious reason to pause and reconsider the alliance.
And of course, he praised him in that way that Mussolini was often praised, that he got the trains to run on time. It's the worst possible praise that one can imagine, given what Hitler did. But again, is there a reckoning coming, do you think? I mean, you'd think at a certain point people would recognize that this guy has gone off the deep end.
So in Western capitals is recognition of Erdogan going off the deep end, but not among Turkish voters. In June, the ruling Justice and Development Party got 40.7% of the vote. They weren't able to form a government. They went to early elections. Erdogan restarted the war with the PKK. When they counted votes a second time, he had almost 50%. So the Turkish people have been snookered. They are prideful. They are an honorable people, but they're being misled. The economy now is extremely fragile. Turkey's regional relations are on a bubble. More and more in Washington and other Western capitals, there are concerns that are being raised. And Turkey's heading in the wrong direction, and it has a dark future.
Well, what do you think the war next door is going to? How is that going to impact it? It seems deeply ironic to me that the U.S. ally Turkey is attacking the Kurds, who are the only people that are an effective fighting force against the Islamic State. Russia's now joined in, and Russia, as you mentioned, furious. Putin's furious with Erdogan. He's cut off trading ties and tourism because they clearly deliberately shot down a Russian plane. Now that the Saudis have broken with the Iranians, not that there was much of a chance of a rapprochement, but there was some kind of effort made that seemed to bear fruit, that at least the Saudis and the Iranians were sitting down together to try and come up with a solution to the agony in Syria, and that's been blown up by the deliberate killing of a Shia cleric by the Saudis, which has had the predictable response of the IRGC, by the way, were the ones that went in and burned the Saudi embassy, my understanding is, in Tehran.
So you raise an important point, Ian. And it has to do with the Syrian Kurds. They're called the People's Protection Forces. We've been giving them weapons, and U.S. warplanes have been flying in support of their ground operations. They've essentially established a buffer all along the Syrian and Turkish border. To Erdogan and Turkey, the idea of an autonomous Kurdish state in Syria is anathema. So they issued a warning to the Syrian Kurds. Don't cross west of the Euphrates and try to connect territory with Jarablus. If you do, we're going to take that as a hostile act, and we will shoot at you. When the People's Protection Forces did cross west of the Euphrates in hot pursuit of ISIS fighters, Turkey turned their warplanes on the Syrian Kurds. So there's a real question about how the U.S. is going to square the circle. Its best allies in Syria are being attacked by its NATO ally, Turkey. So what are we going to do? What side are we going to choose? Is our short-term interest in counterterrorism going to trump our long-term interests in Turkey? Right now, the Syrian Kurds have proven to be reliable. We shouldn't leave them hanging. If they need more support, or if Turkey turns their warplanes against them, then we have to stand in solidarity with the Syrian Kurds who are fighting and dying in the battle against ISIS.
But meanwhile, now that it looks like this agony in Syria is going to go on longer and it's going to get worse, even though they have at least agreed to allow food into these pockets on the border with Lebanon, where Assad's forces have besieged towns and starved people to death, and then in the north, Islamic State have besieged some pro-government towns, and they're starving them out too. They've made a deal to get food in, but it gives you an idea of the dimensions of suffering in this war, where half the people have been displaced, the country's in ruined, and about 300,000 have died, and God knows how many people are starved, and many of these children who've been starved will suffer permanent effects. So is there any chance, do you think, of the U.S. and Russia working together now that everybody else seems to be on the wrong side with Iran and Saudi going at it and Erdogan proving to be completely unreliable?
No, I really don't see the U.S. and Russia working together. There's very little room for cooperation. The Russians, likewise, are attacking groups that the U.S. is supporting. It set up its base, but its warplanes are attacking more moderate anti-Assad elements. These are the elements, the Free Syrian Army and other groups that we've been supporting. Russia doesn't seem to have a strategy, an exit strategy or a military plan. So there's nothing good that's going to come in Turkey in Syria for the foreseeable future. There's no grand alliance which is going to stabilize the country. The good news is that we were able to get humanitarian supplies into these 400,000 people who are under siege. But frankly, that's just a drop in the bucket. The need is so enormous. The suffering is so serious. It's hard to see how we can improve the situation unless we deal with the core problem, which is a sustainable peace agreement for Syria. And with Russia and Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Iran all treating different factions as their proxies, hard to see how we move forward from here.
Well, just in closing, what do you think is going to be in the president's State of the Union? You know, he's got a tough challenge here to be optimistic and reassuring to a scared nation, even though I think our fears are, you know, I mentioned earlier we're spending 60% more on defense today than we spent during the Cold War, and we had a real enemy back then, and now we're terrified of a handful of these Mad Max marauders driving around the desert in Iraq and Syria. So it seems that he's got a tough job, and of course, not the least of which is now the spanner being thrown into the works by the Navy ships running aground and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard seizing the sailors.
So look here, President Obama ran on a platform of withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan. Right now he's thinking about his legacy. He's not looking at how the U.S. can project force and solve the problems in Iraq and Syria. He's thinking about how we can withdraw honorably and stabilize the situation. At the same time, I don't think he's going to talk very much about Iraq and Syria in his State of the Union address because he doesn't want to call attention to problems. And he definitely doesn't want to scare the American people by talking about the Islamic State as a new kind of terrorist organization, one that controls territory, one that projects force internationally in Tunisia, in Crimea, in Egypt. So he's not going to be talking about those issues. He needs to reassure the American public. But the fact of the matter is, ISIS is strong and getting stronger. We may have taken some territory back, but they are still an effective fighting force. We're not going to wish them away by ignoring them. The U.S. has to be engaged. The president needs to lay out a plan. I just don't think the State of the Union speech is going to be the forum that he'll choose to describe U.S. efforts to try to stabilize the Middle East.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always great to speak with you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and he's the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He was a foreign affairs expert and former senior advisor to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why a handful of terrorists have the most powerful nation on earth living in fear. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, War and Ideas, Selected Essays, and his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And John, you're quoted in today's New York Times in an article that talks about the challenge facing President Obama, where he is trying to assure the nation and reassure the nation. And of course, it couldn't be happening at a worse time in terms of speaking about progress in fighting terrorism when the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are holding U.S. sailors hostage. But in today's New York Times, you're quoted in the article describing how Obama is perhaps going to address the issue of America's fear of terrorism. The data that is quoted that you've come up with is that the annual risk of dying in a terrorist attack in the U.S. between 1970 and 2007 was 1 in 3.5 million. So why do you think – well, let me ask you this. How does Obama speak truth to a fearful nation?
Well, it's really hard. The bully pulpit is something of a myth, I think. He can try to calm people's fears, but it's not clear that he has the capacity to do so. If they want to be afraid, they want to be afraid. And you can say things like, for example, your chance of being killed since 9/11, in other words, in the year since 9/11, the American's chance of being killed is about 1 in 90 million per year. And you can bring out statistics like that and point out that your chance of being killed in an automobile accident is about 1 in 8,000 per year, and it frequently simply doesn't have any impact at all. In general, what's happened since 9/11 is that the fears of terrorism have really not dropped at all, even though there was no second attack, even though Osama bin Laden was captured, even though there's hardly been very little terrorism in the West, and even less, obviously, in the United States. And even though the rhetoric has toned down some, and even this is even before ISIS rose, that there really hadn't been much change. People were still said they're worried about as worried as they were in 2001. They still felt there'd be a large attack coming in the near future. They still thought that the United States was winning or losing the war on terrorism at about the same rate. If anything, they felt less safe than they had before 9/11. So it's a little hard to see how a president's speech can change that concern, that fear.
Well, obviously, it's a problem for the president. He's getting slammed by the Republicans. When he tried to reassure, when he talked about the Islamic State as being the junior varsity group and basically tried to dismiss them, maybe he should have put it in perspective back then when, I mean, the point that I was just making to our previous guest is that, the United States spends about 60% more per year on defense than it did on an average during the Cold War when we had a real enemy. And what we're up against now is a kind of few thousand of these Mad Max marauders driving around in Toyota pickup trucks. And yet we're even more afraid. And I think we spend more than the top 20 other nations on the planet, most of whom are allies. So there's a huge gulf between defense spending and the security that it provides. And that's, after all, why we're supposed to defend ourselves, to feel secure. So I don't know what's going on here. There's just a vast transfer of money going on, and I'm extremely suspicious about it. And it seems like the American people are enabling a bunch of contractors to rip off the taxpayer.
Yeah, well, I think that's essentially the case, that basically it's bottom up. The fears basically are conducive to people playing to them and exacerbating them and, of course, profiting from them when they can. If people are living in a false sense of insecurity, and you can play to that false sense of insecurity, then you're going to cash in big time all the time, basically saying that your main goal, of course, is to increase security. Overall, ISIS, and maybe it is a JV. I mean, when they took over Mosul, for example, they were not even trying to take over the whole city. They're just taking over part. And they made so much noise and commotion that the army that was there, that is brilliantly trained by our brilliant army, it costed trillions, billions of dollars, just basically deserted. So it's sort of like the JV team playing playing the grade school team. They won mainly because the Iraqi army just sort of fell apart and deserted. It doesn't show a whole lot of military prowess. There's also been a huge increase in concern when they executed or beheaded some American journalists in 2014, and it's perfectly reasonable to be outraged at that outrage, but beheading a bunch of defenseless hostages is not exactly a case of a condition of showing a great deal of military prowess. So the impact that they have seems to be substantially exaggerated. The amount of, and mostly, of course, they're focused on the issue of the Middle East and trying to kill other Muslims, particularly Shiite Muslims. They not really have as part of their game plan setting up this so-called caliphate. They're not really have a game plan of attacking the West, particularly, and very little of that has happened. And does not seem particularly that the Paris case is something that's the wave of the future, though we'll have to see if that changes in the future.
So is there, just back to tonight's State of the Union, which is coming up, and as I say, as far as I know, my producer's checking the wires to see what's happening with these sailors being held by the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But at this point, it looks as though the president's going to be speaking to the nation when these kind of death to America shouting characters, the IRGC, are holding U.S. sailors hostage. So that's not very good optics to begin with. I think it just shows you, and actually this is a question I've always had, and I've asked a number of specialists about this, and I haven't been able to get a decent answer about it. If you look at the recent political history of the United States, it's hard to believe that the American people and their politicians control our political destiny. Bobby Kennedy would have been president, but for Sirhan Sirhan, who came out of nowhere with a grudge from the Middle East, and helped elect Nixon. The Ayatollah Khomeini unquestionably helped elect Reagan. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden certainly helped re-elect George W. Bush, and so on and so forth. And now you've got another example of obscure actors in the Middle East whipsawing America again. In this case,
you also saw that with the beheadings, because before the beheadings in 2014, there was very little support in public opinion for getting back into the Middle East. And after the beheadings, there was considerably increased support for sending in ground troops to actually fight them. So people do react that way, but it doesn't follow. Therefore, the government should necessarily spend billions of dollars or even trillions of dollars going after concerns that are generated substantially by an under-motivated hysteria. But frequently that happens. Obama has been trying to keep the lid on it and has done a fairly good job of that, I think, overall. But he hasn't been very good at swaying public opinion, and it may be very difficult. Eisenhower tried to sort of dampen fears about World War III from the Soviet Union when he was in office, and he certainly had the gravitas in the background to try to do that, and the popularity, too, and he was unable to do it. So it doesn't, you know, if people are afraid of something, they tend to be afraid of something. A lot of this has to do with a sort of connection, a sort of a spooky connection to some vast international conspiracy. In many respects, it's similar to fears about communism within the United States, domestic communists during the Cold War. There, too, you had a bunch of people who were very spooky, it seemed, and they're connected to this big international conspiracy with roots in both Russia and the Soviet Union and in communist China. And it was, you couldn't tell who they were. And J. Edgar Hoover is saying that they were moving around with a way that no non-communist could even understand within the United States, trying to take it over. People bought that. Another comparison, basically, is very depressing, actually, is with the witches. Between 1480 and about 1680 in Europe, there was a witch craze in which people became very concerned that there were women in particular, but sometimes men, in their midst who were in league with it with the ultimate spook, namely the devil, and they were, you know, causing famines and causing disasters and causing deaths and causing upheavals within Europe, and so there was a effort to try to expunge the witches, and tens of thousands of them, maybe even hundreds of thousands, were executed, burned at the stake. And it was a similar sort of thing. In other words, it's kind of these people within us, we can't really tell who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, or in this case, good women and bad women, a sense of trying to persecute them and prosecute them without very much evidence one way or the other, and without really looking at the threat in a sensible way, in a holistic way.
Well, indeed, and I'm sure many of the women who were burned to the stake as witches were simply strong and spirited women. Just in terms of the State of the Union and Obama's challenge to reassure a scared nation, I mean, it is pretty hard to believe that the most powerful nation on the earth does live in fear of this sort of remote possibility. It's kind of the flip side, I guess, John, of the idea that you can win the Powerball lottery that's up to a record jackpot. I think the odds for winning that are like 292 million to one. And what are the odds that you gave for being killed by a terrorist in the United States?
Since 2001, it's been something like 1 in 90 million.
1 in 90 million, yeah. Yeah, so.
The lottery thing is actually a pretty good example. What happens is, it certainly is seen in San Bernardino, the violence can be essentially random looking at it. And when people look at the lottery, they say, I know my chances are just as good as anybody else's. And so they buy the ticket, which is, of course, completely irrational. The sensible thing is only the first part. My chances are really small, so they shouldn't buy a ticket. It is true that your chances are equally good as anybody else of winning. But that's irrelevant. The question is what are the chances, not how is it compared to everybody else? And something like that is we're having sort of a lottery in reverse. The thing is, well, there's a very small chance that I would be killed, but my chance of being killed by a terrorist, because it essentially is random, or at least seems to be, is the same as anybody else's. So it's actually the same sort of random, the same sort of irrational projection that seems to be motivating a lot of people. And when you got this sort of spooky thing about it, you know, who are they? We can't tell what they are. And, you know, they look just like us, and they're conspiring underground, and they move with a force that we can't understand, and so forth. It all sort of compiled together to create this sense of fear, or in some cases even hysteria.
Well, I think it just serves to show how, you know, unstable the world is, and how we can get whipsawed. But of course, if we weren't there in the first place, maybe we wouldn't have so many problems, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, one thing you pick them out of is just thinking about, does the United States really have that many interests in the Middle East?
Right.
Should we be that deeply involved in it? Do we really need it? And if it's going to succumb into turmoil,
right,
should we continue to spend the huge effort and lose blood to try to control it, particularly when our record at doing so in this entire century has been essentially abject failure? Do we really want to keep doing that? Do we really need it? And this question should be brought up a lot more frequently, it seems to me.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. John Mueller.
Okay, thanks. Nice to be here. Good luck.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies, and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, War and Ideas, Selected Essays, and his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back hearing from two presidential speechwriters about how the president may get out from under the unfortunate optics of the moment and deliver his reassuring, inspiring, optimistic speech. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Halperin, who is a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, a senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And we'll also be joined in a moment by Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. But David, the White House have already told us that to expect the president to deliver an unconventional State of the Union address that is both optimistic and reassuring. But of course, the optics of the moment, even though these U.S. sailors that are being held by the Revolutionary Guard Corps, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, are supposed to be released, it's not a good thing, is it, to be trying to reassure the nation about the progress in the fight against terrorism, to have a bunch of terrorists holding American sailors?
Well, it's not great. I don't know that a bunch of terrorists are holding American sailors. It sounds like the sailors may have drifted into Iranian waters. Iran, you know, is a sovereign nation, as much as we may disagree with them. If they were in our waters, we would seize them, I can bet. and they say they're coming home. So I don't think it's a huge tragedy. Of course, we, you know, want them to get out safe, and I don't think it's huge news. And if I were the president, I wouldn't particularly, you know, although he's been accused of brushing off threats, this is one that isn't worthy of, I think, too much focus in the State of the Union address. I think there's all kinds of other ways that the administration can communicate what's going on here besides through the speech.
But how's he going to, because the Republicans are piling on, presidential candidates are, you know, it's not as if they haven't been piling on already, suggesting that he's weak. And I just wondered how if you were writing his speech and you vetted the national security aspects of President Bill Clinton's speeches, how would you thread this needle?
Well, I think the president, I think he can be faulted for kind of minimizing threats, saying that, you know, ISIS was the junior varsity and that they've been contained. Those are legitimate criticisms when it turns out you're wrong. ISIS is not a blip because ISIS is killing people and inspiring other people to kill. It's committing horrible atrocities in places where we've claimed in the past to care very deeply what's going on, Syria and Iraq. And frankly, you know, terrorism is not, although only, you know, you only had a 1 in 3 million chance of being killed by a terrorist over the last 40 years, terrorists can do real harm. They flew a plane into the World Trade Center. They could blow up a chemical plant. That was something that Senator Obama focused on quite a bit. We haven't made our chemical plants safer since then. They could unleash a Bhopal. They could do a cyber attack. So these are real threats, and I think the president ought to do the following. I think he ought to be honest with the American people about what's at stake. I think he should not give in to what some of these candidates are doing and try to scare people about terrorism. I think he should give people a sense of what they ought to do, be vigilant, and I think he ought to have serious programs aimed at looking at what the real threats are and how to address them. George Bush invaded Iraq. That was counterproductive to our fight against terrorism. But there are smart things that the government is doing and that the president's been doing to take on this threat.
And Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C., he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. And before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Thanks for joining us, Paul. And as David just said, in fact, our previous guest, Dr. John Mueller, provided these statistics, which are in the lead article in today's New York Times, that the risk of dying in a terrorist attack in the U.S. between 1970 and 2007 was 1 in 3.5 million. So how does President Obama, how does he get around this conundrum of how to speak truth to a fearful nation?
Well, as my friend and colleague David Halperin just said, it is a conundrum. It is true that the individual likelihood of being harmed by a terrorist is quite low, but human nature is what it is. And you can tell people all day long, every day, that the threat of dying in an airplane is way, way less than dying in a car, but people are more nervous getting into a tube that goes 30,000 feet into the air, flown by others, than in a car on the ground driven by them. And there just is a difference between, the chances of falling and killing yourself in the shower, which is probably higher than being killed by a terrorist, in people's minds. And that's just human nature, and you can't deny it, and you can't argue against it. But the key is getting the balance right. I think David's right that early on he tried his level best to get across that that ISIS was not an existential threat the way, say, the Soviet Union having thousands of nuclear-tipped missiles aimed at us was. And he's certainly right about that. But you can't talk to people about what you're going to do to solve a problem without letting them know that you get, at some visceral level, their concern about the problem. And I think my guess is you'll see him do a very good job of that today.
And David Halperin, what do you make of the White House's saying that this would be an unconventional State of the Union? I mean, I recall the State of the Union where a Republican congressman shouted out, "You lie," and this is a president who's been just absolutely relentlessly assaulted by the Republicans. And as I mentioned, they're, you know, I've watched CNN where they're quite gleeful about this this Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps capture of these U.S. sailors. There's a lot of people in that room that have wanted this guy to fail. They've done everything to make him fail, as Mitch McConnell pledged to do. He doesn't owe them much respect, does he?
Not really. I don't think he does. I don't think they have treated this president with respect in the way they should have on the Republican side. It sounded like the president was going to say we need to get past the old politics. Of course, that's what he said in his inaugural address, and we didn't. And I'm afraid that with the way that redistricting and the Republican Party has gone forward, it means you elect extremists. If you move to the middle, you get primaried and lose. You've got a chamber, in my view, of very hardline Republicans. I don't think the Democrats, particularly, notwithstanding what some reporters might say, have really particularly moved to the left. I think they're basically where they were, and the Republicans are much more conservative. I don't know what the unconventional State of the Union is. I hope he'll use puppets or something to try to get the Republicans to open up. You can't get John Boehner to cry anymore because he's not there. So I don't know what he has in store. But I think all he can really hope for, I mean, I think he should, you know, there's an opportunity for the president in a way to gloat and say, look, I do have a good record, and you guys didn't get rid of me. I'm still here after 8 years, and I'm the president. I think it would be nice to see some humility and some more efforts to extend an olive branch. But in reality, that's not going to go far. I think he just needs to stand up strong for what he's going to do this year and how he's going to do it. And the Republicans can go ahead and jeer if they want to, but I think he'll move ahead.
So, Paul Glashaus, what can the president do before this forum? Because he clearly wants to be succeeded by a Democrat, and I imagine it's Hillary Clinton he has in mind. And because if he's not, we know that they'll undo everything he's done, including the Iran deal that's supposed to, on Friday, the money is supposed to change hands. So can he use the State of the Union as a way to rally the American people to vote for a Democratic candidate in the 2016 presidential election, short of encouraging them to vote the Republicans out of the House and Senate?
The single best thing politically that he can do in this speech is paint the picture of what he intended to do when he came into office, what he's done, and what the results have been. It is quite a dramatically good story. Most people don't quite believe it, but you know, if you go back and look at polling in 1996, 97, most Americans back then didn't believe that the economy was working, that crime was down, that you know the abortion rate was down, that welfare was down. It took a couple of years before people felt it. People are only beginning to feel it now. He needs to make the argument that his administration has been a success against enormous odds and get his poll favorability ratings up. The higher he can get those favorability ratings, the more, according to past elections and what political science tells us, the more he puts the Democratic nominee, presumably Hillary Clinton, maybe Bernie Sanders, the more he puts that person in a better chance of winning. And as you say, that is the biggest unfinished aspect of his legacy. He desperately wants and should want a Democrat to succeed him. But, you know, explaining to the American people his success, what he's gotten done, what the theory of his actions have been, and what the results have not been something the president has done a very good job of doing. He more or less abandoned the entire effort in the first term and slowly in the second. He's got a little more comfortable tooting his own horn. I've read mixed things about whether he's going to do that today. I certainly would, you know, hope that they will, because it's a very, very important aspect of this speech, although there are others.
And David Halperin, what's your sense of what he can do using this forum, I mean, I must say I'm astounded at how the Democrats, particularly the DNC, lost an opportunity to put a Democratic narrative out there with their candidates, Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, and Bernie Sanders. We know that the Republican presidential candidates have been getting huge ratings on their many, many debates, and they've got another one on Thursday. And it looks as if the Democrats or the Democratic machine, if you will, deliberately buried these debates, which is, I think, bad for Bernie Sanders. Clearly, it's bad for Hillary Clinton, and it's bad for American democracy. So, you know, I think a lot of Democrats are wondering, you know, when are the Democrats going to take their gloves off and, you know, fight back a little?
I think having the debates on at 4 in the morning or Saturday night or whenever they've been on was a bad idea, even if it was seen as a strategic advantage for Senator Clinton. I think in the long term, it was probably bad for her, too. I mean, they're inherently less entertaining than the clown show that the Republicans have been putting on, that people have been watching for pure entertainment value. So I think it may not matter much, these debates. I think there will be a nominee. That nominee, I think, will be much more in tune with the needs of the American people than whoever the Republicans end up nominating. So all of this may be, to me, potentially a lot of wasted time. The Republicans are going to go through, you know, this whole process, but they're going to end up with somebody that ultimately, in my opinion, and I'm often pessimistic about these things, but in my opinion, this time the Republicans just aren't going to come up with somebody who can satisfy them that they're a plausible, good, strong president for the country. And I think President Obama tonight has the opportunity to, again, make the case that we had peace and relative peace and relative prosperity under 2 8-year Democratic presidents, sandwiched in between a president who put us in a horrible mess with economic mismanagement and with getting us into wars that we didn't have any plan to get out of. So I think he can make a strong case, and that whoever's nominated by the Democrats, probably Hillary Clinton, can pick that up, and the Democrats will be in good shape in the one area, which is the White House, whereas everything else, it's pretty much a disaster for the Democrats.
But to Paul's point of the president has tended to hide his light under a bushel, is it time for him to take some pride in what he's achieved in spite of the incredible odds of a dysfunctional, divided, and hostile legislative branch?
Yes, and I think there's a way to do it that embraces his victories as victories for common sense and for the American people without doing what he'd probably really like to do, and a lot of us would, which is to say it was over the objections of these, you know, stubborn and short-sighted and ultimately wrong Republicans. So I think I'd like to see him not take a victory lap, but make the case for progressive government and why he needs, in the next year he can take these achievements to the next level and say, Republicans, why don't you join us in doing these wonderful things? They won't, but I think it's a nice way to put it.
And Paul Glastris, is there a possibility that the president can talk about some of the things that need to be done, at least that he's suggested need to be done, particularly repairing the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court struck down? The Supreme Court just yesterday heard a case coming out of California that could defund, essentially, or eviscerate public sector unions if the court rules the way that many expect. And I guess all of this sort of is a subtext for letting the American people know that if the next president is a Republican, then they will have even more conservative pro-corporate justices. And this is as Bill Clinton himself, now out on the stump, has pointed out, it's very likely in the next president of the United States will have one, two, or three Supreme Court appointments.
Well, I'm not sure it's appropriate for a president to warn the public of things that will happen that are beyond his control, like, you know, how the Supreme Court will rule. But I do think and expect that the president will point to a number of things he would like Congress to do, and specific doable things, and push in that direction. I think he'll say that, having stood strong for a sensible, pragmatic process in Congress, the Republicans have now met his demands, and there are, you know, we're not going to have during the rest of his administration, you know, shutdowns or brinksmanship over the debt limits. I think he should claim that as a victory for bipartisanship, but of course, say it in a way that's a victory for him, and then challenge the Republicans and his own party on things like that he wants, on his priorities, the Pacific TTP trade pact being a major one of them, the shutdown of Guantanamo being another one. There are things that he wants to get done. That is really what States of the Union are about, and I you know, people. Sort of belittle them as laundry lists, but I was reading the 2000 State of the Union that David and I worked on for Bill Clinton. It was one heck of a laundry list, and I checked it against the things that got done in the year 2000, and it was quite a few. I mean, there were literally half the things Bill Clinton called, half of the two dozen things Bill Clinton asked Congress to do got done. Now, it was a different Republican Party then, and he was a different president. But you know, this is a blueprint for action for the year, and there's still actions that Obama can get through Congress and actions he can do on his own. And I'm really hoping that he doesn't listen to the pundits and does have something of a laundry list.
Well, David Halperin, surely the one thing that he's trying to do on his own against an intractable Congress that's very much in the pocket of the NRA, that is gun safety, and he's already sort of laid down the gauntlet on that. How do you think that's going to play out tonight?
I think all the president can do tonight is to express again, as he did so eloquently the other day, that this is really a human issue, that there's really an urgent need to do something, and just kind of try to lay the groundwork. It's a more long-term project, I think, to try to figure out how to sell to our public and our, you know, added our history in our country a way to deal with this gun crisis. But he's not going to be ending it with the cooperation of Congress this year. I also want to say hi to my friend Paul Glasser and urge you all to read his great publication, The Washington Monthly.
Well, I was about to read his very impressive bio, and I guess just in closing, gentlemen, at least the optics are going to be a little different. We won't have a tearful John Boehner. We'll have is he still bearded, by the way, Paul?
I don't know if he's still he shaved it or not.
He's sitting next to the guy that he ran against as vice president, right, last time. So
that's right.
It should be interesting. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you, David, for the plug.
And again, Paul Glastris is the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glastris spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. And also joining us was David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republican Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and a special assistant for national security affairs to President Bill Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.